Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, Hard Makes a Difference. I'm Claiborne Cooksey and welcome to the show. We are on season 2, episode 11, and today our topic is tangling with aquatic invasive species. I've got Alan Katzenmeyer with me today, chief of the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species Branch with the Environmental Laboratory, also known as EL. Good morning.
Hey, great to hear from you.
How are you?
Thanks for having me on today.
Glad you're here. We've got a lot of questions to get to, so we will jump right in with what you do at ERDC. What is your role?
Sure. So I'm the chief of the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species Branch here at ERDC. We have 26 full-time federal employees, 9 ORI students, which are the equivalent of like postmasters, postdoctorate students, and then we have 5 federal contractors right now that work for the branch. We travel extensively. We do a lot of work in the field focused around aquatic ecology, specifically invasive species management and endangered species monitoring.
So tell me a little bit about yourself and your background, what steps you took to get to where you are, and what is your relationship with the community?
All right. Well, I am from Vicksburg. It actually all started with STEM. So I cannot thank Chuck Dickerson enough, Jenny Dickerson, Eddie Melton, all these other guys that actually started the robotics program. I was a participant in that program in 2004 through 2006. During that time, I actually was introduced to ERDC. I got to meet a really interesting character who had, at the time, I think 19 snakes in his house, Dr. Jan Hoover, along with a couple other animals, and a huge cast of characters that I have the privilege of working with now. Went back in 2007. I actually started an ITL whenever I came back part-time, and then I transferred over full-time in 2011 after I finished a bachelor's and master's degree.
Nice.
From there, 2014, I was a contractor for 3 years. I switched over to a federal position and haven't looked back since.
Very cool. I love that. I love it. The snake thing, though. Yikes.
You kind of, that's not even the that's not even anomalous anymore. There's so many unique people I get to work with on a daily basis. That's mm-hmm. background noise to the other things that go on.
I love it. So you're the chief of a branch dedicated to aquatic invasive species. Let's talk a little bit more about that. What exactly is an invasive species and why are they a problem?
So invasive species are also known as non-indigenous species, which are organisms that are not native to a particular area in which they have been introduced. Invasives are really imperiling the recovery of 42% of our federally listed threatened and endangered species. In total, about a third of our nation's freshwater fish are threatened and endangered, and 72% of our mussels are imperiled. So invasives are really the second biggest threat to biodiversity outside of habitat loss in the United States right now. Cumulatively, there are about 6,500 terrestrial and aquatic invasives that are believed to cost around $138 billion annually in economic damages. I mean, it's really wide-ranging. If you think about the impacts, they're felt from agricultural crop decimation, such as when we have wild hogs come in and tear up your corn. That happens a lot in the Mississippi Delta right now. Loss of recreational fishing, such as when you have silver carp and bighead carp introduced. Clogging of waterways is something a lot of people don't consider when you have floating aquatic vegetation, such as giant salvinia or water hyacinth. And then the reason we really care about that is because endangered species have to compete with invasive species. For the finite resources we have in the aquatic environment, endangered species are typically specialized feeders, whereas our invasive species that we've brought in are more generalist. So we're having to compete for that resource. And if we can manage for that invasive, then we're actually really helping out the restoration of endangered species.
Right. Very interesting. Are there certain types of environments that are more vulnerable to these aquatic invasive species?
Sure. So that's unique because you have to look at the invasive species in the geographic region that you're working in. Like I said, invasives are generalists, meaning they survive over a really wide range of environmental conditions. They're not finicky like your grandmother who has to have the house at 80 degrees. They can survive through wide temperature fluctuations, salinity fluctuations, and a lot of other environmental conditions. They can also grow a lot faster than our native species. So simply put, they can just literally outgrow and they have a huge reproductive time lead. So if you think about our native species, the paddlefish, Polydons bathula, it can take 10 to 11 years before that animal can actually become reproductive, whereas a bighead carp can become reproductive in 2.2 years and have over 100,000 eggs in the first hatch. Their high dispersal potential, so that's something we study quite a bit of within Erdic right now, is how fast can these fish swim? How fast can they disperse to new habitat? Versus if you have a invasive tree, it's not exactly moving very quickly, so it would be easier to eradicate that tree, but not in all instances. If it has a high seed dispersal rate, also has a lot of phenotypic plasticity, which is a fancy way to say it can adapt to its environmental conditions through its physical traits. And it's also associated with humans, ornamental plants such as water hyacinth and other plants that people seek to put in their gardens. A lot of times they don't realize it's a highly invasive plant that then gets introduced. And then 10 years later, that water hyacinth you put in your water garden is taken over the 50-acre lake next door. Yeah. Your neighbor's thrilled about it when they have to spray all the herbicides and various chemicals to control it.
That would be my luck, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Very much so. And it happens a lot more than you think. A lot of times you'll go into these garden centers, none locally. All the local garden centers are very good about it.
Yeah.
But if you go out of state, my spouse loves it when I want to go to the garden center to see what invasives they have around. And I've found water lettuce 2 weeks ago, which is an invasive species in a garden center in Louisiana. So people just aren't aware these floating ornamental plants are a major threat to local river ecosystems.
When you see that, do you point it out to them? Are you like, this is a red flag?
I'm normally like, hey, do you really know what this is? And it's a very awkward conversation typically with the individual that has no choice in stocking the plant, but it does happen.
Oh, man. Okay, so moving on, why is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Erdic, involved in managing invasive species? I mean,
More than about 67 to 70% of goods consumed by Americans and half of the oil we import move through USAIS managed ports. So we're an astronomical impact on commerce. We're responsible for maintaining about 12,000 miles of navigation channel, along with 600 plus dams, 257 locks. We're really entrusted by the nation to be good stewards of that 12 million acres of land and water. The infrastructure we have created has also worked as a perfect pathway for invasive species to move throughout our country. And by the very nature of what we're maintaining overseas transport. So whenever you have accidental introductions via our ports, that's where they can have a great point of origin to start spreading. The USAIS environmental mission, if you read it, it really revolves around restoration and stewardship of the land. And so to meet that criteria, we have to manage the invasive species. And we are the number one provider. A lot of people don't realize how much land the Corps actually owns and operates. We have about 368 million visitors per year come to a USAIS facility. So that's astronomical. That's more than the Department of Interior. And with that, we have 383 major lakes and reservoirs. I mean, the National Park Service can keep the mountains.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you rather go to one of our lakes? It's a very, really unique perspective that we have to think of whenever we're trying to manage our systems for invasives. And other impacts economically. So these small communities, if you think about some of the small areas like Lake Bissonneau, which is about 2 hours west of Vicksburg, the town has a massive problem with giant salvinia. Giant salvinia is a floating aquatic vegetation. It's a highly invasive plant. Scientific name is Salvinia molesta. That plant has destroyed the local economy because if a boat can't launch out of the ramp, they really can't spend their money locally in the economy buying fuel, buying supplies for their day on the water.
Totally.
And that has a huge economic impact, not just whenever we think about commercial ports, but these small fishing lakes. Yeah. And when we're dealing with invasives, we also have to consider things like harmful algal blooms and other things in the water that have economic impact because people are no longer able to go to those swim beaches. They're no longer able to enjoy the recreational opportunities that we provide within the Corps of Engineers. And a huge problem we have is any regulation we incur because we have a new endangered species that's listed, it's going to create a more stringent regulatory burden on the mission of the Corps of Engineers, which is going to limit when and where we can dredge along with other activities. And this can directly increase our cost of projects that we have to now take into account when there's a threat.
It's important work.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
61 North Mini Storage has four locations for your convenience, three of them on 61 North and one on the corner of Oak Ridge and Culkin Road. Now with new state-of-the-art security. Come in now and get 10% off, meaning your rent could be as low as $29.70 a month. Choose from 5x10 to 10x30 or the climate-controlled 10x15 up to 14x24. You'll have access 24/7 with your own private code to check on your stuff. For more information, stop by the main office, 955 Highway 61 North, Vicksburg. 61 North Mini Storage.
The next time a power outage occurs, you can be ready thanks to Neil Gas. Vicksburg's locally owned and operated Neil Gas is now a Master Cummins generator distributor. They sell, install, and service Cummins generators along with propane, tankless water heaters, propane fireplace systems, and infrared heaters, 24-hour emergency service too. And they offer several payment plans. Check them out online. Neil Gas. That's Neil with two L's. NeilGas.com.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Alan Katzenmeier, Chief of the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species Branch with the Environmental Lab, also known as EL. This is something I've always wondered about. How do these invasive species end up in our waterways?
So there are really two modalities. One is purposeful introduction. So think about some of our historical things we're fighting right now in the state of Mississippi. You have ornamental plants such as kudzu that were brought in for erosion control, then quickly escaped and is now a major issue that we're fighting.
Yeah.
Other releases that we have are also your bighead and silver carp. They were brought in under a permit the Fish and Wildlife signed in 1972-1973.
Really?
They were brought in, for aquaculture. They're actually heavily used to clean out some of your stock ponds, and they were also thought to help with some of the sewage treatment plants as a cleaner for those plants. Then you had a flood event, and they were accidentally released into the environment.
Yeah.
And that took about 10 years, 12 years before they were really able to see reportable numbers. And since then, they've spread all 2,300 plus miles of the Mississippi River all the way up to the Chicago Sanitary and Shipping Canal. The other way there is accidental. So you have that accidental release where you have a contained population, then you have a spillover event, and then you have other cases where it was just simply brought in on the ballast of a ship. Or it was brought in as a surprise visitor or surprise guest on a piece of equipment that came from outside the United States. So you look a lot of times, an example of that is people wonder why we have to have heat-treated pallets or we have to have some weird regulation or plastic pallet. It's because there's actual things like emerald ash borers or other invasive pests that can come in on pieces of wood. And then they get introduced into the environment.
Wow, crazy. How big do carp get? Do they get huge?
They can.
Okay.
So you can look at some of the largest in the world right now are about 119 to 130 plus pounds. I'm not sure on the exact number, but yes, they can grow astronomically. And that's due to them being extremely efficient. They're going back to that journalist idea. They're great at filter feeding, whereas a paddlefish may have an efficiency uptake of 3 to 5% for however far it moves. A paddlefish can actually, or a bighead carp can filter up to 20% of the particulates in the water. So it's just far more efficient per unit effort of movement.
Interesting. Very interesting. So we talked a little already about how invasive species can pose a significant threat to native fisheries, disrupt ecological balances, inflict economic harm, and hamper recreational activities. What are some things that can be done to mitigate this threat?
Sure. So we'll go back to the river example. The Mississippi River is the second longest river right now in North America. The Missouri River is longer by 1 mile, according to someone who I don't think measured it correctly. But no, that's okay. The river flows kind of from Lake Itasca in northern Minnesota all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. During this about 2,340-mile journey, we're draining 32 states and two Canadian provinces. So the drainage basin area is 1.15 million square miles. And that's hitting a huge amount of just the total, over 60% of the United States. Mississippi River at Vicksburg is moving about 768,000 cubic feet of water per second and 5.7 million gallons during that period. What's really hard is once you introduce an invasive to a system that big, you're going to have very limited success and control. Mm-hmm. And so you want to prevent that initial introduction.
Yeah.
And so prevention is really the best way we can address this situation now. And moving forward, we've really been great about making sure no invasives come in, and early detection and eradication, because once they spread into that 2,300 plus mile river system, control will be hard. Now, we can prevent when we have bottleneck situations, meaning you have a lock and dam where we can put things such as electric barriers or acoustic barriers to prevent upward migration. But in the lower Mississippi River, the lower 1,100 miles that are free flowing, we don't have natural, or we don't have man-made construct to block their passage.
Nice. Can you tell me more about the invasive fish species, just all the different kinds? Just touch a little bit more on that.
Sure. So historically, you would have something called the Asian carp family. You have the big head carp and the silver carp, which people know silver carp for the fish that jump out of the water when a boat agitates them.
Yes.
Big head carp are the sister species to that. There's two other species you don't hear as much about. Grass carp. They're originally brought in as a triploid fish, meaning a sterile fish. Turns out they weren't sterile, and they were accidentally released. Then you have a new introduction. It's a molluscivore called the black carp. We just found some of those around the Bonnie Carey spillway structure several years ago now, and they're steadily spreading. So we have multiple detection efforts going for that. Some of that's being led by Dr. Rick Lance for environmental DNA detection of those species and traditional monitoring by Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, along with the Mississippi agencies that are monitoring for that. Those make up your Asian carp family. Mm-hmm. But like we talked about earlier with invasive fish, it's really specific to the geographic region, where we have blue cats here that are sought after for recreational fishing. They're highly invasive in the James River. Mm-hmm. So whenever you go to Virginia, a blue catfish is an invasive pest species. And so it was introduced into the James River, mm-hmm. and it's taking up the majority of the biomass now in some stretches of that river system. So it's a huge problem. Another issue we're fighting right now is the lionfish. The lionfish is a marine species. It feeds on crustaceans and fish, including snapper and grouper. So commercially important fish are now being impacted by the lionfish, which was an ornamental fish that was released accidentally or purposely. We're not really sure on the origin of that at this point. So invasive fish are really unique in the fact that once they're in a river system, they just have this unrestricted ability to spread.
Wow, very interesting. Electric barriers. We talked about that a minute ago. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. So ERDC is really into electric barriers right now. Mm-hmm. We've been hosting that research by Fish R&D, a contract group that we work with, for the last 10 years. The Chicago Area Waterway System, also known as the CALS and previously known as the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, it's gone through several names at this point, has had a demonstration barrier online since 2002. It was actually originally built for the round goby, which is another invasive that's in the Great Lakes right now. Mm-hmm. Two more barriers, of course, excellent at naming. They're called Barrier 2A and 2B. They could have more fun names, but for some reason, they never do it. They became operational in 2009 and 2011, respectively. Barrier 1 North became operational in 2021, and Barrier 1 South is slotted for completion in 2023. I know, just you want to say like draft A, draft B, but no, each one has actually built upon previous lessons learned from other barriers. Mm-hmm. And in true Army Corps fashion, we're going to have redundant systems for that added layer of protection. It's great because I've gotten to see the evolution of that. So an electric dispersal barrier is really meant to stop fish passage upstream. It involves multiple aspects. You have the biological, the environmental, and the technical limitations of each system, but you also have those same variables for each fish species you're trying to control. So biological would be your fish size, your fish species, swimming speed, ecological, and motivation to move upstream. The environmental aspects, because it is a system that is moving water, you're going to have water depth, water velocity, water connectivity, and water temperature. A lot of people don't think when we salt the roads in Chicago, what happens to all that salt? It changes the salinity of the water in that system, which changes how electricity moves. Mm. And then from there, you have the technical aspect, and this is where the core thrives. You have the electrode orientation, field temporal properties, such as electric barrier and the electric current density and time, and spatial properties of the barrier, such as maximum voltage. We have to work very closely with the Coast Guard to make sure we're not going to actually hurt a person while we're keeping these fish out of the system. Yeah. So when you factor in all those different environmental and technical barriers and just all the little nuances to these systems, you have to have a lot of research to actually learn how to operate the barrier itself. And that's where the ERDC really displays its power, is we can bring in all these different teams of subject matter experts to say such a complex problem and then make it into something that is a tangible outcome where it's just a computer program that tells them how to run their own barrier system. So it's great. It's really neat to combine the physiological aspects of an animal with the technical application of a barrier.
Right. Interesting. What are some ERDC projects, other ways that you're managing the invasive and endangered species in our fisheries?
So we work on, like I said, I have a team right now of about 26 full-time federal employees. We have about 11 of those members. They are considered the fisheries team. We also have an invertebrate team. So we have Dr. Audrey Harrison that's running that program. So you see all the mayflies, all the chironomids, all the like species no one really considers because they're the base of the food chain for everything else. She actually researches that. So she's looking at putting in large woody debris back into the river system to actually establish habitat for all these macroinvertebrates. And that will actually help with fisheries down the road because it creates forage. Other things we're dealing with, we have Dr. Todd Slack. He's working with Gulf Sturgeon Restoration. So if you think about Camille Cut and all these other historical hurricanes that have damaged our coastline, it's also influenced how Gulf Sturgeon and some of our endangered species are coming back. They're anadromous, the Gulf Sturgeon is, meaning it lives in the marine environment, then migrates inland to spawn. And so he's actually doing a telemetry array where you insert a tag that pretty much pings a signal every 60 to 90 seconds and is detecting when these fish are moving into and out of the system. And that helps us look at like dredging windows and when it's safe to actually be in those areas. And it's monitoring the health of the sturgeon population. So that's just some research. We have Dr. Nathan Harms. He's part of the plant team, another group we get to work with. He's looking at ways that biological control organisms, like I said earlier, these non-native species are actually coming in from other places. So we're going back to the origin of the species and seeing what controls them in the native habitat. And it's just fascinating work. He also, he could have his own story because it's amazing to see where he gets to travel. He's been to South Korea multiple times. We partner with a lot of other international agencies because they can go out and help us do these field data collections. So he works with all these groups in South Africa and South Korea right now looking for control mechanisms.
Like there's probably never a dull moment.
No, never a dull moment. And I love it because it's such a passionate group of people. And then we also run a facility right outside of Dallas, the Louisville Aquatic Ecosystem Research Facility. It's a 100-plus acre facility committed to whenever we have these major construction projects, how do you restore the plant assembly, the like community of plants and vegetation before an invasive can come over? And they do far more complex work than that. Lindy is probably just dying on the inside because I cannot articulate it as well as she can. But they really work towards restoring habitat. And so when we think core, we're thinking scale. So we're not just working on a 10-acre plot of land. We're working on thousands of acres at a time. And so Lindy's team will go in and they'll actually look at design criteria and they'll help actually grow the plants, then go seed the vegetation further out. And so those are just four team members. We have 20 plus team members at any given moment doing work. Dr. Ian Knight's working on cold tolerance right now, where he's seeing what kind of thermal chill capacity can some of these biological control organisms have, and does it match the invasive plant itself? So I can just go on for days. I absolutely love getting to work with this team of individuals. We have Dr. David Ruppel and Dr. Nikki Fauché, they both just recently joined the team. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at projects like the Yazoo Backwater. They're looking at water quality. They're looking at the assemblage of fish in an area pre- and post-construction. Mm-hmm. So almost anything that deals with the environment and with general ecology, we have a subject matter expert in.
Very cool. Very cool.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Lorelei Books believes the best books point us home to Mississippi, and Stephen Manheim's photography collection, Mississippi Signs, is the perfect way to take a journey through time. Signs across our landscape are not just a nostalgic connection, but an important tie to Mississippi's rich history. In the decades before mass technology, retail signs were an important link between local businesses and the customers drawn to their doors. Vintage signs from places like hotels and restaurants, hardware stores, and theaters are disappearing, but this book preserves the beauty and significance of signs across the Magnolia State. Deep narrative for the photos reminds us of the story behind painted storefronts, such as the Biedenhorn Candy Company and the Biscuit Company in Vicksburg, and mounted signage at the Hotel Vicksburg. Manheim is an award-winning photographer who combines his passion for photography, history, and vintage advertising to create Mississippi signs. This is Kelly Barfield at Lorelei Books, where we see signs of Mississippi's soul, keeping our love of literacy and learning alive.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
If you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Alan Katzenmeyer. He is the chief of the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species Branch with the Environmental Lab here at ERDC. ERDC has a long history of undertaking aquatic invasive species. Can you tell us a little bit about the history and maybe some partnerships that have been formed along the way?
Absolutely. The fisheries ecology team is one of the longest running teams right now at ERDC, I believe. The grass carp research originally started in the 1980s, and we have projects even before that that started under the Aquatic Plant Control Research Program Biocontrol Technology Area. Most of the studies were mesocosm, meaning small, just think 300, 400-gallon tank, and pond studies. They were conducted in partnership with the University of Florida. The team really started moving more and more with funding from ABCRAP and other teams. In the 1990s, they had a lot of work in the Santee Cooper Riverway system where they started stocking grass carp, an invasive. So it went back to, we thought this was a really beneficial species that started to reproduce on its own.
Right.
And from there, the end of the 1990s, we really started to see more and more silver and bighead carp research picking up. That's whenever they were starting to note them more and more in the environment.
Right.
From there, that's when the Aquatic Nuisance Species Research Program began really investing in bighead carp and just general invasive fisheries research. So that was great. We picked up electric barriers around 2005 or so, and that project continues to this day. As we're building new barriers, we're learning how to operate those barriers and how to better design the next generation. And we're moving more and more to where's the origin of the fish. We're working right now on a project where you're actually taking the otolith, so the eardrum, out of a fish. And then using a laser to actually find some of the stable isotopes in that fish. And that determines where that fish, the larval stage of that fish, actually started. So we're not just looking at what happens to the adult form. We're going all the way back to looking at what happens to the larval. And I mean, when this research started, I don't think that was ever a dream some of the founders of these teams had.
Right.
So it's great to see. And we actually still have Dr. Jack Kilgore. So he is still with our team as a rehired annuitant, and he's providing guidance. And that's a great thing that's really unique to ERDC, is we have such a long history with programs like this, but we also have a really great institutional knowledge.
Yeah.
So when people think of ERDC, they don't realize most of our people, they start here with the idea of wanting to retire at ERDC. They're unlike a lot of private industry where they're going to move around every 5 to 6 years. Dr. Jack Kilgore was here for the first wave of the Yazoo Backwater Project, and now he's here for the second wave of the Yazoo Backwater Project. And he's actually training my next generation of researchers, Dr. Todd Slack, Dr. David Ruppel, and Dr. Nikki Fauché. They're actually learning from the person that sat on some of these original review groups. So we have that longevity in ERDC. versus working with private contractors or working with other people in a unique application. Urtica is all over the nation. We service every district, and we also service our national and international partners. So whenever they have a problem that's on the East Coast, we may have had a project on the West Coast that already solved that issue. And so we're bringing in districts that may have no reason to talk to each other, and we're partnering with them and leveraging other capabilities that we've had in the past to help future groups and to help those districts. It's a cost savings for them that they're not having to reinvent some type of Fish and Wildlife Service permit or a NOAA incidental take authorization issue. We already established that research. So it really helps drive our national priorities.
Love that. And it's such a gift to learn from somebody with so much experience, too.
It's very humbling to get to work with the people that wrote the original papers. And that's across Urtica. You get to see so many emeritus individuals that have been there for 30, 40 plus years. And I think that's really unique to the Urtica culture that we have there, that people enjoy their jobs. I've been on enough tours with me to realize, like, my researchers love talking about what they do because they're truly passionate about the work. And that's what makes us effective.
For sure.
They care. They genuinely want to care about the research, and they want to see the project to completion. Yeah.
They want to see it make a difference.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. What does the future hold for all of this, for this research?
So with terrestrial and aquatic invasive species, we're just going all over the place right now because there's so much research opportunity. We're looking at multi-deterrent systems, so not just electrical barriers. We're actually looking at how acoustic barriers, bubble barriers, light barriers work. We're looking at risk assessment models to determine how the operation of our flood control structures may influence the spread of aquatic invasive species in estuaries by temporarily creating freshwater bridges. Like I talked about earlier, we're moving 660 Olympic-sized swimming pools under the Vicksburg Bridge right now every second. Whenever we open up these diversion structures, such as the Bonnie Carrier, the old river control structure, higher and higher, we're creating freshwater plumes throughout the Gulf of Mexico. And so we want to see if these aquatic invasive fish and plant species are actually able to survive at various salinities. And so we're testing those physiological barriers that we may be able to create. We can use that to our advantage down the road in how we operate our structures. That's one aspect of what we're doing. We're also looking at the impact of climate change on the range expansion capabilities of invasive species and how we can start to address those issues. A lot of invasive weeds, if you want to know the epicenter, go to Florida. We have remote employees, Dr. Ben Sperry, down there right now, right outside of Miami at University of Florida. He's pretty much in the heart of all our invasive species research. We do a lot with that, and he's looking at various climate impact changes, looking at some of the herbicide work in partnership with one of our local team members, Dr. Bradley Sartain. Then we have another remote employee, Dr. Chris Mudge, down at LSU. They work on the chemical aspects of, hey, are these plants becoming more resistant to the type of herbicides that we're spraying, and what can we do to better manage by better application of herbicide? So they're looking at refining how we spray down to the droplet size. When you spray an herbicide, what droplet, what surfactant, what temperature regime is it becoming resistant? And it's the phenotypic expression different depending. So you have different seed banks. So there's a really cool aspect going on with some of the plant work we have. And most importantly, for the future as a whole, we're really working on partnerships. Like I said, we manage millions of acres of land, and we can't do that alone. We work quite a bit with the USGS. We actually have Fish and Wildlife Service people inside of our office, just so everybody's aware of what everyone does. So we really leverage our partnerships to better understand the environment as a whole. And some of the work the USGS is doing right now is that they're looking at fluvial egg drift simulations, which is a cool way to say, how long does the egg stay suspended in the water column? So we can slow the water down. If that egg drops out of suspension, it will die. So how do we manipulate the river to create less suitable habitat for our invasive species while making more suitable habitat for our endangered species? So there's really unique work going on with that right now on just how larval fish disperse. Where do they go the first few years of their life? That goes back to some of the laser ablation work that we're doing. Is we don't understand the life history of the fish, so it really hurts us and not understanding how our models are being generated. Right. So we're looking at refining dispersal capabilities, all these really interesting models and work. Other things we're doing is we're actively transitioning lab research. Mm-hmm. We don't work necessarily in the theoretical world in my branch. We work for direct application. So a customer comes to us and they want to know, how do we address this problem that we have in our district? How do I get rid of this weed that is blocking my reservoir? You don't think about submerged aquatic mm-hmm. vegetation, it can cause a lot of sedimentation issues, which results in the dam not being as efficient. So how do we control that submerged aquatic vegetation to make mm-hmm. our reservoir have a longer lifespan before we dredge? So we're working on that. Oh, all kinds of just fun projects. There's never going
to
be a dull day.
I was about to say, y'all have a lot on your plate.
It is, and it mm-hmm. has nothing to do with me. It has yeah. everything to do with the researchers and who came totally. Before me on my team to set up such great groups that have this institutional knowledge and the infrastructure. Totally. The facilities that we have right now are next to none. We have had major renovations. We have amazing facility managers in EO, mm-hmm. Adrian Eckstein, and all kinds of other team members that are coming in, and they're helping us look at 3, 5, 10-year plans, what's mm-hmm. on the horizon, and how do we get our facilities and our infrastructure ready to address the next phase, the next challenge that we have. Totally. So we have the resources available for mm-hmm. us now to address not just the issues we see today, but to forecast for the next 5 to 10 years where we need to be. And these are very complex. Mm-hmm. It's when you look at our abilities, mm-hmm. It has all these nuanced pieces. You can look at the DPW staff, even down to Erdick. They're mm-hmm. highly trained. Not just anybody right. can install no, a no. lot of the equipment we need. Right. So down to the support teams mm-hmm. we have, they are in it for the one mission, and that's to serve our customers.
Totally. Talk about teamwork.
It is, and it's great. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Takes a team. So people always want to help. You know, what can our listeners do to prevent the spread of these aquatic invasive species?
The most important thing individuals can do right now is prevention. It's the easiest way mm-hmm. is if you pick up a bucket of bait where you cast net in one lake, don't take it to the next lake. Yeah. You don't actually know what you picked up. Mm-hmm. Ornamental plant trade, ornamental animals. So there's a really mm-hmm. unique, I was able to work with several individuals, Bobby McComas and Jay Lindsay mm-hmm. on a project in Puerto Rico, okay. and they had a huge problem with invasive iguanas. And mm-hmm. I remember them warning me, like, hey, an iguana may jump out of the tree.
Oh,
I was like, come on, I'm not that naive. Then I saw an iguana jump out of a tree, and I was like, this is really dangerous. We should be wearing hard hats.
Yeah.
Because what happened, people had pet iguanas, and then they deployed and released their pet iguana.
Imagine, people just don't think, you know,
they don't
that
think,
could happen.
No, not at all.
Hello.
And all of a sudden, you have an island full of invasive iguanas that hang
jumping.
Out over.
Jumping
yes.
iguanas.
When they get scared, they jump into the water. And I really thought they were just joking with me until I saw this giant animal belly flop. And I was like, I'm out, guys. I've never once heard the safety protocol for this.
That's terrifying.
But yes, yeah. so mm-hmm. just understanding yeah. when you release your pet, that mm-hmm. is an invasive. Look yeah. what's going on in the Florida Everglades right now. And you have all these invasive pythons, all these invasive snake species that have decimated your small mm. mammals. And that's yeah. because someone didn't want to kill their pet, which yeah. I get 100%,
right,
guys. I don't
right.
want you to hurt your pet. Mm-hmm. But send it to a proper reservation where that animal is not going to be released into the wild. Because
totally.
By you not addressing it, it's causing billions of dollars in Man. Impact. And we're not getting it back. The ecosystems are going to be forever changed due to man-made releases. So prevention mm-hmm. is the number one control that okay. we have right now.
Okay. Awesome. Good stuff right there. What do you want listeners to remember from our conversation today?
I think really the most important thing is mm-hmm. the Corps is here to help. Yeah. We really want at Erdick to solve problems. That's mm-hmm. what we like is the uniqueness. That's what draws every one of my team members mm-hmm. to work at Erdick and to be so happy and thriving at Erdick
totally.
Is we're here to help. We're not this giant government agency that just sits around. We're a very active group with I have in total about 30 people that travel. We clocked mm-hmm. 1,200 nights in the field last year.
Wow.
And so we're mm-hmm. not just here. We have a global impact at Erdick. We're not a regional office. We get to travel everywhere, and we get to help out a lot of different districts.
Nice.
And so Erdick is an amazing place to work. It's an mm-hmm. amazing place to get to partner with. And that's what we want to see. We want to make sure that the community knows that what's going on behind the gates isn't just a normal day-to-day operation. It has a global impact. And we're very, very thankful for the community and what they help us with.
Totally. All right. You heard that. Alan, thank you so much for being here with me today. That was amazing information. I'm Claiborne Cookesy. This is Beyond the Gates, How Erdic Makes the Difference. We will see you next week.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Now News Talk 1490 and 107.7 FM presents the legendary Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. And now...
Now, the rest of the story. It has been said, if Charles Lee had been born in Philadelphia rather than Chester, England, he might well have become Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army during the American Revolution. And from that position, one presumes... he might have become father of his country, our country. But enough of what might have been. Here's what happened. In early 1775, British troops, red coats, were becoming a familiar sight in the city of Boston. To the colonists, it was an intolerable situation. So the First Continental Congress urged the colonies to strengthen their militias. That way, should Massachusetts be threatened by military aggression, she could count on the support of all America. Now, by this early stage of the mounting hostilities between the colonies and the motherland, the Continental Congress, still hoping for a peaceful solution, had just in case acquired an unofficial military advisor, a gentleman widely recognized among, quote, the greatest military characters of the present age, a retired British officer, Colonel Charles Lee. Colonel Lee of the 16th Dragoons, a veteran of numerous campaigns in as many lands, best known for his exploits commanding the 16th, a fierce, shrewd regiment of heavily armed cavalry. And one can imagine the delight of the Continental Congress upon learning that the same Colonel Charles Lee had adopted the cause of the American patriots. Congressmen were also impressed that Lee's wit and charm and intelligence indeed allowed him to discuss the philosophy of Jean Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau with the same ease that he might elaborate on military strategy. But most assuring of all was that he was the Lee of the 16th Dragoons. That made him the commander who had hammered that regiment, the 16th Dragoons, into a cunning, devastating fighting machine at which history would marvel. Colonel Lee had shown the 16th how to win all the time. And now the American colonists hoped that he would do the same for them. So before independence was declared, Charles Lee was commissioned a major general in the Continental Army. George Washington himself requested the appointment, and Lee inspired his fellow patriots with his brilliant military ideas. He gave his soldiers confidence in themselves and in their prospects against the British, and they believed in him, too. After all, he was Charles Lee of the 16th Dragoons, the dread 16th Dragoons. And yes, General Lee did play a significant role in the Revolutionary War. Although his service was comparatively brief, there was no telling how far he might have gone. You see, in Portugal, he had taught his crack British regiment everything he knew about warfare. So they knew him very well. They knew him too well. And so on December 13, 1776, the almost invincible General Lee was outwitted. He was outwitted by his own magnificent monster, the one he had created, and caught off guard and conquered and captured in New Jersey by his own British 16th Dragoons. And now you know the rest of the story.
When you were a kid or even as an adult, have you ever left your mark on a tree through carvings or a design in concrete? Think about why you would have done this. Could it be that you wanted to leave something about you as a mark or to allow generations to know something about you? Memorialization is similar. Memorialization is a very important step in the bereavement process. This gives family members the opportunity to showcase the life of someone for which they cared or allow someone to display their achievements. It will tell the legend of a person outside of the stories that passed from generation to generation. When beginning the steps of memorialization, think of all the delightful experiences that you had with the person. Think about their hobbies, military service, interest, where they worked, anything that will help create a lasting timepiece that will be displayed during the course of time. After all, names with dates do not allow for much information. Let Greenlawn help design your memorial or a memorial for your loved ones. We will strive to bring you the pleasure and excellence you deserve. Greenlawn Gardens Cemetery, 191 Highway 80.